Now, originally, The Word for World is Forest went to print as part of a collection titled Again Dangerous Visions, which was gathered and edited by famed science fiction writer Harlan Ellison. There it appeared alongside works by authors such as Kate Wilhelm, Ray Bradbury, Kurt Vonnegut, Piers Anthony, and many others. The novella earned Le Guin the 1973 Hugo Award and also a Nebula Award. The overall reception of the work was positive, and The Word for World is Forest earned praise for its direct, hard-hitting depiction of resistance to and the horrors of colonial violence. Somewhat ironically, criticism of the novella mostly emerged when the story was compared not with the writing of other authors, but with Le Guin's own early body of work. Many critics praised the story as a remarkable contribution to science fiction, and at the same time it was felt that this was not a Le Guin enough piece of writing when compared within her own collection of published works at the time. So much for the critics. Now imagine the publication of The Word for World is Forest not today, but in the United States of the late 1960s and early 1970s. The height of the American colonial occupation of Vietnam, the peak of J. Edgar Hoover's vision of an unrestrained, racist Federal Bureau of Investigation that could and did systematically undermine Black power, Red power, feminist and womanist movements, and other liberatory organizing. And of course, a time that saw the groundwork for the fledgling so-called war on drugs and the groundwork of the Nixon administration's economic, political, and cultural war on Americans of color and indigenous communities worldwide. As I understand it, to cultivate the collection, Harlan Ellison issued an invitation and a challenge to writers in his circle. That challenge was to write novellas and short stories that the authors believed they would not be able to get published by major publishing houses at the time. Now, if this is true, Le Guin's novella was birthed from a spirit of rebellion, resistance, and devious excitation for something that would give us a hard look at the empires in which we live, despite the tendency of publishers to water things down for the mainstream. The Word for World is Forest was then born out of a departure from and a critique of popular science fiction of the day, and in this way, it might count as one of Le Guin's most Le Guin works. So with that little bit of literary history as some foreground, and hoping that others here today with more of a background in Le Guin's writing might fill in some of the pieces, maybe I've got some of that wrong, let me turn to talk about the first version of Heinisch cycle pedagogy. And so part one, teaching a fine balance of reason and dream. My own peculiar activism and scholarship hangs about somewhere at the broad intersections of direct action organizing, philosophy, and public policy. I dabble just enough in troublemaking, questioning, and intervening to keep a wobbly seat as full-time faculty member at Guilford College, a situation that always feels tenuous at best. A quick aside, a couple of years ago, I had lunch with a Nobel Prize-winning economist, Amartya Sen, and when I described the terms of my employment, he wasted not one single moment to tell me I sit in what he would call a folding chair. I have no idea whether he meant for it to comfort or insult. And either way, I still find it as amusing as accurate. Anyway, I like to think that when I'm at my best, I learn from and teach the writings of anarchists, abolitionists, troublemakers, gadflies, dreamers, and shit stirrers, insufferables to malcontents, and those who wonder aloud with imaginations that reach well beyond the confines of a properly logical human experience, and with the kind of focused reason that translates between dreams and strategies. Le Guin is usually one of the loudest voices in my thinking, or at least her stories are frequently on my mind, offering constant counsel. Le Guin's Heinisch cycle writings have given me several specific touchstones, which I both rely on in terms of the content of what I teach and the pedagogy, or how I teach. So here are a few of those touchstones. One, keep authority decentralized as much as possible. Centralized authority left to proliferate leads to domination, and domination leads to systematic cruelty. Two, we own nothing, and we share more and cooperate more than we realize. Propertarian thinking is an aberration worth abandoning in favor of collective sharing. In fact, two former students I taught over a decade ago at Oregon State University have taken this lesson from Le Guin's novel, The Dispossessed, and although they may seem like a typical suburban family, they quietly and intently raise their children without the language of ownership and property. There is no mine in their home. There is only what we use. Third, cooperate for the long term and reconsider a sense of time and generation beyond one's own brief life. A sense of time that might be called vaster than empires and more slow, which is another of Le Guin's phrases and the title of her 1971 short story. That is, if we are truly concerned with liberation and a sense of social justice, we will probably do better to understand whatever work we do now and within our lifetimes. And at the same time, we won't likely live to enjoy the benefits, even though that work matters to us in the here and now. What we do now, we do for future generations, whether or not we ourselves live and die in a time of deep injustices. The centuries-old and millennia-old systematic oppression that dominates our lives could end overnight, as some optimists would have it. It could go on forever, as some pessimists would have it. And it could come and go in cycles, as some anarchists imagine. Injustice can also fade to the point where organized cruelty ends up episodic and occasional, never quite gone, and yet never more systematic and persistent. Who can know? But we can imagine it, and that's a hell of a good sign. I'm not sure whether the phrase comes from a Taoist proverb or from authors like Nelson Henderson and Russell Sage, but as the quote goes, the true meaning of life is to plant trees under whose shade you do not expect to sit. Or, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, the second best time is now. Again, these are just some of the bits of Le Guin's guidance I draw on. Teaching strategy as an organizer, reasoning as a philosopher, and systematic analysis as a policy advocate requires a weird dance around different methods, and often in ways that never polished up quite right. There are always uneven edges and jagged threads, and when push comes to shove, I lean pretty heavily on a twofold fine balance. Borrowing the phrase from Le Guin's The Word for World is Forest, I'm going to call this the fine balance of reason and dream. Reason, which is a core concern for philosophers, remains an ancient and ongoing mystery. Trying to characterize reason too quickly or with any finality is a fool's task and sure to fail or lead to folly. Even so, I tend to teach students to perhaps think of reasoning the way Ludwig Wittgenstein talked about concepts as sharing family resemblances. In this way, reason refers to our attempts to organize by drawing not simply on cold rationality or deductive logic, not on finding one pure essential concept as Plato might have it, but by taking something like an over all of the above approach, blending from emotion, rational abstraction, logic, inference, deduction, hypotheses, and so forth. So like family members, these different versions of reason, these different parts have much in common and they differ all at the same time. And then there's dream, just as elusive and murky and thankfully so is reason, if not more so. Orbiting about dream and dreaming, we might find myriad notions of awe, wonder, fancy, musing, curiosity, embellishment, and of course the immutable faculty of imagination. I admit that I feel for students I teach who, to their credit, must wonder at my hairpin turns from analytic inquiry to imaginative visions as I move rapidly from one to the other. In one moment, I might insist on the honed precision of a discreetly worded rhetorical précis, as Professor Orozco taught me, thankfully, to write as part of a policy analysis, something that is strict and concise. And in the next sentence, I might turn to some weird lines of esoteric poetry, and just for kicks, I'll add in a light dusting of metaphysics and epistemology. Now, almost every teacher I know, whether they admit it or not, seems stuck in some sort of civil war between reason and dream, as if we can somehow pick a side. This was one of the last biggest troubles for the late Joe Franks Jones Jr. III, a beloved friend and mentor who died in 2015. Questions of reason and dream and how best to teach philosophy and mathematics occupied much of Joe's thinking during his last few months. The professor of philosophy, Jones had spent most of his career leaning to the idea that most of us learn philosophy and math when we encounter thought experiments, allegories, and story problems that represent so-called real-world challenges to analyze and solve. The idea is we would learn all sorts of skills or forms of reasoning and imagination much better if we have a practical problem to solve. So in other words, Joe long believed, as many do, that the practical relevance of an alleged real-world problem would motivate us to some kind of passion for wisdom. Yet in his last few years, he had a profound change of mind. In one of his final pieces of writing, and something I know mostly through conversations with him, Joe argued that maybe by beginning with relevance and practical problem solving, we could go awry. Thus, he began to argue the most worthwhile thing we can do is to invite students into abstraction and sheer reflection for its own sake, into the reaches of deep reflection on questions of wonder, metaphysics, ontology, phenomenology, and so forth, where we can exercise and play with pure concept. Just play with concepts and abstractions. As this thinking and research grew, Joe found several prominent mathematicians who shared a parallel view. Teach not the practical problem first. Teach the abstract math, and our wonder for problem solving will then have fertile ground. He would ask me, what other than far-flung pondering of being in existence could possibly be more interesting to a college student? If only we could get out of their way with our sad demands that they apply their questions to something relevant. In the end, Joe surmised that our best chance of teaching students to conceive of philosophical wisdom and rational analysis, such as in mathematics, begins with wonder and the play of abstract thought untethered to practical application. Reading The Word for World is Forest, some similar questions and lessons appear. The indigenous Aschanes, and let me pause to say, I think all lovers of literature have their preferred pronunciations of terms, so I'm not sure, but just, you know, I'd like to know how to pronounce this. The indigenous Aschanes live and share their lives in waking and dreaming, each no more or less real than the other. The Terran human colonists who have come to occupy the forests and extract resources cannot seem to understand the way the Aschanes rest, dream, sleep, and wake. Of course, the goal of the Terrans is to enslave the Aschanes and put them to work as expendable laborers. Just about halfway through the novella, Le Guin writes, quote, many Aschanes, especially dreamers from the lodges, could not change their polycyclic sleep pattern to fit the Terran one. If they caught up with their normal sleep at night, that prevented them from catching up with the REM or paradoxical sleep, whose 120-minute cycle ruled their life both day and night, and could not be fitted into the Terran workday. Once you have learned to do your dreaming wide awake, to balance your sanity, not on the razor's edge of reason, but on the double support, the fine balance of reason and dream. Once you have learned that, you cannot unlearn it any more than you can unlearn to think, end quote. Teaching students to practice with various tricks and tools, learn through the practice of organizing and the study of philosophy, how to both analyze and investigate, as well as how to wonder and grow their imaginations, seems to often require that I strike a fine balance of reason and dream. Now, fine balance of reason and dream, this phrase might conjure images of some skilled acrobat carefully tiptoeing across a tightrope with a bucket of reason in one hand and a pail of dream in another, high above a treacherous abyss with jagged rocks of uncertainty and injustice far below. And if we falter to uncertainly, ironically, we fall to certain doom. Yet teaching is never really that elegant or impressive. Mostly for me, finding a fine balance of reason and dream involves wading through a bog, which is a big clumsy mess. Often it works well, mess and all. Sometimes it falls flat, and that's just how teaching goes. Teaching is sometimes about finding a fine balance of reason and dream. And in The Word for World is Forest, there's also another way, and something I'm going to refer to as the way of devious nerves. So, part two, another way of power, or devious as nerves. As I mentioned earlier, before so many words about reason and dream, I first learned to read and teach Le Guin by way of Professor Lonnie Roberts. After that first experience, I had the chance to watch her teach The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas many more times. Through those observations, I learned a particular lesson about storytellers like Le Guin. That is to treat each description, each detail of the setting and scenery as a painstakingly and lovingly chosen invitation into the imagination of another place and time. I now teach Le Guin the way Professor Roberts taught me those many years ago, which is begin by asking students, tell me about Omelas. Tell me about Anaris. Tell me about the forests where the Aschanes live. Each time, a few hands go up, and those first to speak launch quickly into their interpretations of the broader socio-political implications of Le Guin's writing. They can't help themselves, and neither could I when I first sat in class and Professor Roberts invited us, tell me about Omelas. I do now as she did then and ask students to pause, to start over, and tell me about the place. What is Omelas like? What is Anaris like? What are the forests like where the Aschanes live? Tell me about the place Le Guin wrote for you and spare no detail. Let's go there together before we do anything else. For me, one of the most remarkable things about Le Guin is her ability to weave her insight and wisdom into the tiniest detail of her craft. She places these countless fragments of her perspective in the most modest turns of phrase. So let's go for a moment to the forests where the Aschanes live and the way Le Guin styles the foliage in our minds. Near the beginning of chapter two, Le Guin writes, quote, all the colors of rust and sunset, brown reds and pale greens, changed ceaselessly in the long leaves as the wind blew. The roots of the copper willows, thick and ridged, were moss green down by the running water, which, like the wind, moved slowly, as many soft eddies and seeming pauses, held back by rocks, roots, hanging and fallen leaves. No way was clear, no light unbroken in the forest. Into wind, water, sunlight, starlight, there always entered leaf and branch, bole and root, the shadow, the complex. Little paths ran under the branches, around the boles, over the roots. They did not go straight, but yielded to every obstacle, devious as nerves. The ground was not dry and solid, but damp and rather springy, product of the collaboration of living things with the long, elaborate death of leaves and trees. And from that rich graveyard grew 90-foot trees and tiny mushrooms that sprouted in circles half an inch across. The smell of the air was subtle, various, and sweet. The view was never long, unless looking up through the branches you caught sight of the stars. End quote. It is this phrase, devious as nerves, and the imagery it evokes that catches my attention. Devious, from the Latin for another way or out of the common way. And nerves, from the Latin for vigor, force, and power. And I believe Linz Whitaker is here and might school me on the Latin and Greek, but I'm going to go with it. In teaching, there are sometimes these ineffable, devious, nervous moments when odd things happen in collective reflection and discussion, and something occurs that cannot quite boil down to our imaginations and reasoning. Whether we call it a flow or being in the zone, it is a collective moment of power that finds another way through our relationships. These devious as nerves instances might be the intersubjective relational convergences when we understand and cooperate with one another in the moment to feel and think our way around ambiguities. In particular, when the ambiguities are paradoxes or those situations that block our thinking and cause us to suffer, these things that come out of structural oppression and institutionalized cruelty. But it can happen with regard to all sorts of subjects. When we follow threads that none of us individually could have understood and no teacher or student autonomously derived, when the devious as nerved teaching happens, the flow of experiences, thought, and wonder harmonize even briefly, such that the radical differences, our alterity, right, the mysteries about one another that are just a matter of fact, and our commonality spark a collective response that exceeds any individual's description. When we feel and act simultaneously as deeply unique in our complexity and also share in a collective similarity. These devious as nerves happenings are almost impossible to describe anyone who wasn't there in the moment. Teaching from an anarchist fragment such as those I borrow from Le Guin can sometimes turn into situations where our devious as nerves tune us into the ecosystems of imagination, consciousness, and conscience that form out of relation. Or as Martin Buber puts it, the humane I-thou relationship in which we imagine how we are more complex than what we can know about one another. When we refuse to treat another person as an it, as an object, and in doing so, we refuse to objectify ourselves. And in light of the forest Le Guin describes, Buber's theory might need one more term, since in teaching, devious as nerves instances seem to be when I-thou turns into I-thou-we, a collective relational moment. It is in these unpredictable, devious as nerves contexts in which I suspect students and I begin to feel ourselves and our collective power in what I can only describe as an entirely new dimension. As far as I can tell, finding a fine balance of reason and dream and the skill it takes to juggle the mess of analysis and wonder can play a role in setting us up to share these devious nerves, these moments. And at the same time, I don't think there exists any formula to make any moment predictably turn out devious as nerves. Teachers don't make the forest happen. Returning to the novella, Le Guin goes on to add this about the forests. Quote, there was no seeing everything at once, no certainty. The colors of rust and sunset keep changing in the hanging leaves of the copper willows, and you could not say whether the leaves of the willows were brownish red or reddish green or green. Close quote. At this point, I do not know what else to say about this way of teaching and the anarchist fragments that seem to weave us devious as nerves and to show us relational power in new dimensions. Suffice it to say today, Le Guin and other anarchist storytellers have much to teach about one of our most elusive social, political, and cultural concepts, and that is the concept of power. Devious as nerves might be another way to think about power in itself. So, conclusion, devious as nerves and the fine balance of reason and dream. Patricia Hill Collins, philosopher and sociologist and founding scholar of Black feminist epistemology, tells us that human collectives worldwide share something. There's something that happens. When we look at different collectives worldwide, there's a really good chance we're going to find what she calls core concepts. To put this more accurately, Hill Collins argues that there are certain core concepts we would have a difficult time not finding. A particular interest to her is the concept of community, which was for generations defined by the German sociologist Ferdinand Tönnies to simply mean a place of familiarity and respite from the more complicated, threatening, broader society. This, Hill Collins explains, has left us with the dominant popular and academic notion of community that is in reality something too particular to Tönnies and his life. Put differently, what most of us might think of as community has actually been dominated by one German scholar's particular experiences. Hill Collins argues we cannot leave it to anyone else to define core concepts like community. Core concepts, if there are such things, are potential sites of political contestation, and they are also rallying points for our own liberatory politics. When we reject the definitions of community that benefit others and instead define community and other core concepts locally, collectively, and in ways that speak to and from our immediate needs and experiences, then we have the chance to forge a new politics of our own making, by us, for us, about us. Drawing on Le Guin and Hill Collins, I ask students to reason and dream, to reject the definitions of core concepts that emerge from someone else's politics, and to dream collectively about concepts that are local to their lives and immediate to their sense of liberation. This is in many ways what Le Guin has done in The Word for World is Forest. She has taken reason and dream and redefined concepts such as world to instead mean forest. In doing so, she rejects and redefines the all too common word world, which is now the language of the colonizer, with forest. Likewise, Le Guin seems to give us a new way of understanding power, not as authority, force, domination, or control, but instead the way light and leaf, water and root share the forest. For those of you who have never read The Word for World is Forest, and for those of you who have read it, I hope you'll pick it up again and spend some time with the orderly and wondrous fine balance of reason and dream. I also hope you'll find in the story such lessons as devious as nerves that speak for themselves in rich descriptions. Thank you very much.